You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
This episode of Show Me the Meaning is brought to you by Nordic Tracking. Hey everybody, welcome to Show Me the Meaning Wisecracks Movie Podcast.
Show me the meaning!
I definitely thought you were going to say, I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore.
I'm mad as hell, and we're going to show you the meaning anymore!
Anyway, my name is Jared, and I'm joined here with the Show Me the Meaning crew. We got Ryan.
Hey, film fans.
And joining us from the Squanch is Alec.
Hey, I'm mad as hell, but I'm probably going to keep taking it.
Okay, good to know. And we got a special guest this week. So a couple weeks ago, I teased a special guest, and then I got all my scheduling mixed up. So the actual fulfillment of my promise of a special guest is right now, and it is Sage from the Just Right YouTube channel, which I consider to be our algorithm buddy.
That's W-R-I-T-E.
If you watch our videos, chances are his videos have been recommended. So how's it going, Sage?
Hello. Hi, I'm doing good. I didn't know I was a special guest.
You are a special
Welcome
guest.
To the
Welcome.
Pod.
I feel special. That's great.
Well, that's how we do here. Anyway, guys, today we are talking about a very special movie. We're talking about Network, the 1976
Woo!
Film directed by Sidney Lumet, written by Patty Chayefsky. Is it?
I don't know. I think
I don't know what it is. Starring Peter Finch, Faye Dunaway, and William Holden. So actually, before we get into the first impressions, first I want to say, so a couple weeks ago, we did the Patreon poll to do what movie we should do next. Because of some of the scheduling, including scheduling this collaboration with Sage, we had to push Akira. So Akira will be next week. Also, before we jump in, I want to say thank you to everybody who's been leaving us reviews on iTunes. So I've got a couple shout-outs to give out to some awesome fans who have taken time out of their day to give us a review on iTunes, which helps us immensely. So this is from Hernoff from Argentina. He says, they make you feel like you're part of a movie club with your smart friends. Well, thank you, Hernoff. This one's from James Frank 007. He says, I listen to this and other Wisecrack podcasts on the way to work every day. Love the different opinions and viewpoints, and I like how they tackle older thought-provoking films along with ones currently in the public eye. So thank you, Agent James. This one is from CMM102. He says, I've been an avid watcher of YouTube and Wisecrack's channel for a while. Exploring and analyzing interesting movies contrasts with my usual activities as an engineering major. Glad to mix things up for you. And this last one is from Roger Federless. He says, love this podcast so much. Really makes watching movies so much more rewarding and fun. Well, I'm really happy to hear that, Roger. That is the whole point. Anyway, without further ado, let's get some first impressions to talk about this movie. Ryan, what was it like the first time watching this, and what was it like revisiting it?
This movie really changed me when I saw it. This is top 10 material for me. Top 10 movies
all time.
All time. Like, I love the fuck out of this movie.
Yeah.
It's amazing. If you haven't seen it, go watch it. It's a must-see. Yeah. And then we rewatched it, I want to say, what, a month or two after the election?
It was way after that.
Was it?
It was like a year after the election.
No way, dude. It was not a year.
Alec, when was it? When were you last
several
in LA?
Months. Maybe it was several months. Either way, we were like, all right, we got to watch Network in this post-Trump malaise of a world we live in. And it was pretty, we were like all shocked at how relevant it was to today and how ahead of its time it was back in the 70s. It's one of the most egregious Oscar snubs ever, losing to Rocky. You know.
Hey there.
Was it the first Rocky or the second
Rocky? I mean,
hey,
Rocky's cool,
Rocky's
but better than Network? Are you shitting me?
Rocky's my favorite movie, so I'm just
going to say that. Oh, wow. Cool.
Shot star.
But before this, Sage did say this movie is the best. Did not say that, Sage?
It is the best movie, but Rocky is my favorite movie.
So Rocky is better than Network to you?
He's emotionally to me, like, I'm gonna pop in Rocky anytime.
Gotcha.
But Network, you just can't argue with the craft on display and just how prophetic it is. So yeah, I'll give it the title. It's the best movie, but
I hear you. Yeah, and everyone delivers. Like, it's one of those movies where every single person involved is on their top of their game. The writer, Patty Chayefsky, best script ever. Sidney Lumet's best directed movie, I think. Peter Finch, Faye Dunaway, William Holden, all of them kill it in this movie. To really just Yeah, I can't wait to talk about it.
I mean, for any of you listening who haven't seen the movie, this is going to sound like a big old circle jerk, but everything that Ryan said is completely warranted.
Yeah.
Anyway, let's move on to Alec.
So the first time I watched this movie was, I don't want to say you made me watch it, but you're like, Alec, you have to watch this movie. And it was, I was in LA, and I want to say it was July or August or something. But anyway, we got a little inebriated, but even then, like, it left like such an amazing impression. And then the second time I ever watched it was, you know, 3 days ago to watch it, to prepare for this podcast. And it's just like so good. It's so like, it accurately describes, even though some of it hadn't come true yet, like everything happening in our society in a really like sort of prophetic, but also accurate, way. And yeah, it's just so fucking good.
Crazy prophetic. Crazy. All right, Sage, what about you?
So I first saw this movie when I was in high school, and it was great when I was in high school. It's still great now, obviously. But I like it. It's like for completely different reasons, or I think I've changed where, like, back when I was in high school, seeing Howard Beale scream, "I'm mad as hell, I'm not going to take it anymore," like, that was how you felt when you were in high school, right? Like, with, you know, the man putting you down all the time. But now, like in the post-Trump world, I watch Network and I'm like, we need less anger. Like, he's like, Howard Beale's wrong. Like, the problem isn't that we're not angry enough. The problem is that we're like way too angry about everything these days.
I have a question for you, Sage. So you identify, you're like, oh yeah, Howard Beale's my hero because he is articulating this rage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So like, I was right where the audience of Howard Beale is in the movie, right?
So he was like your Tyler Durden, kind of.
Right, yeah.
Okay, yeah, no.
I mean, I think that's kind of how you... I feel like that's how you're supposed to be watching the movie, at least to start, before... But then you kind of start realizing how much of a crazy person he is.
Right. I think if I watched it when I was in high school, I probably would have... Like, Tim, what you're describing to me sounds like when I rewatch Fight Club. When I was a kid, I was like, oh yeah, I want to be in Fight Club. And now as an adult, I'm like, oh no, that's bad. He's the bad man.
And you're not getting it, if you think. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, exactly. It's a misinterpretation of the film. And I think this movie does get misinterpreted by people who are in the news. Like, Glenn Beck is always saying that he wants to be the Howard Beale. Right?
Are you shitting me? He really says that?
He does. And like a lot of guys. I think Alex Jones says that too, right? And like, I mean, he's pretty much been deleted today, but
attempted.
Yeah. Well, we'll see what happens to him. But I think there's a lot of people who, you know, kind of looked up to Howard Beale in this movie, and that's kind of a misinterpretation, right?
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So tell me if I'm getting this right, Ryan. I remember you made me watch this movie the first time. This is back in the day when Ryan and I were fresh into, you know, fresh out of film school, moving to LA. We lived together with like four other dudes in this in this tiny apartment. And I believe we were getting ready for The Master to come out. Paul Thomas Anderson's movie off of the crest of the acclaim of There Will Be Blood. And either it was you or somebody else said that, okay, well, Network is Paul Thomas Anderson's favorite movie, so we gotta watch that. And I remember watching it. I remember liking it a lot, but man, I don't think I got it like at all. And it really wasn't until we rewatched it when Alec was in town that I was like, holy shit. And not only was it great because it was post-Trump, but I think Alec and I had just recently finished the script for our Philosophy of Black Mirror episode, and there, and we focused specifically on this book called The Society, the Spectacle by Guy Debord, which at the time, and this is part of the reason why I said, Alec, you have to watch this movie, because off of the crest of writing that episode, it was just like, oh my God, this is like Society of the Spectacle, the movie. So that was a really awesome experience. And then every time I've seen it since then, I've only seen it once since then, but it's a movie that you think about and you continue to come back to, and it is just crazy prophetic, like crazy how accurately this movie prophesizes all the ills of our age. It's just nuts.
Want to give some examples?
No, well, I was surprised. I figured that it was just sort of analyzing what was going on, and it wasn't until you told me a few things, I was like, oh shit, no, it actually was prophetic.
Yeah, none of this had really happened yet. At the time, the networks were still able to lose money. They weren't answerable to corporate and profits. That hadn't happened yet. And when the movie came out, the reviews were largely negative, and people that were in news would say things like, oh, this is just crass. It's never going to be like this. And then here we are today, and it is exactly like that.
Well, I'd comment on that, though. I mean, you say it hadn't happened yet. I mean, it's one of those things where the seed was happening, and that's what kind of compelled Patty Chayefsky to be like, this is where we're headed. I mean, this is what, you know, the commodification of rage and dissent, you know, kind of like in the 70s and 60s, late 60s, that's what he was seeing. And then he...
Yeah, I'm just saying he was early. Like, it wasn't Captain Obvious yet.
Right, right.
He was a badass in terms of just being able to see it.
I think the context is super interesting. You just mentioned it briefly, but, like... Well, first of all, there was an FCC rule that, you know, there was only so many channels. So if you had a license to broadcast on one of those channels, you had to dedicate a certain portion of your time to sort of cover the pressing matters of the day. It didn't necessarily have to be a news program, but something like that, and sort of share opposing views. And also what sort of happens in that realm is that when you have like ABC or NBC, the news divisions are like a prestige piece. They're always losing money. Like there's a line in the movie where it's like, oh, we lost $33 million. They're always losing money, but all the corporations are saying like, that's fine. In fact, in my research, there was a story where former CBS correspondent Marvin Kalb, no idea who that is, recalls owner and chairman William Paley instructing news reporters at a meeting in the early 1960s that they shouldn't be concerned about cost. Quote, I have Jack Benny to make money, he said, he told them.
Right.
And yeah, and I think maybe what this movie is seeing is like there's sort of like the creeping encroachment of like, oh, wait, why aren't we making money? Well, Jared, you know more about this, but the premise of the movie is that they're acquired by some large conglomerate, but like that really hadn't happened with a lot of the news agencies at the time. But you said that did happen, Jared?
So I want to go into the recap before we start getting into the specifics of the context and the prophetic elements. But to your point, yeah. So the first time that this happened, so the movie came out in 1976. It wasn't until 1985 that Capital Cities Communications bought ABC. And then that was kind of the first one in that direction. Anyway.
It's also the same year that Neil Postman writes Amusing Ourselves to Death, which I think is like
the
best
heard about
book
that
to
book.
Read. Yeah, it's fantastic book. It's probably the best book to read to understand this movie, I think.
Okay.
So we can get into that later, but
yeah.
Okay, cool. Mm-hmm. Well, we obviously just have so much to talk about, so let's get into a recap. So after a long career at UBS, old school newsman Howard Beale gets canned due to poor ratings. When he announces on air that he's going to kill himself and that life is bullshit, the big wigs at Network want his head. But when his public dysfunction yields high ratings, combined with the network being acquired by a conglomerate called CCA that will no longer afford the news division independence, and the rise of an ambitious executive named Diana Christensen, they decide to keep Howard Beale on the air as part of their new anti-establishment programming initiative. Howard's celebrity hits a fever pitch when a seeming religious revelation leads him to inspire millions to express their anger over the status quo. As a result, The Howard Beale Show is the biggest hit the network has ever had. Howard continues preaching the illusory nature of television, the fascistic potential of conglomerates controlling media, and the dulling of the masses through TV, while Diana has an affair with the recently fired head of the news division, Max Schumacher. The network's love affair with Howard Beale comes to a halt when Howard exposes a deal in which CCA will be acquired by an even bigger conglomerate funded by Saudi oil money and calls on his audience to halt it. So the head of CCA, Mr. Jensen, sells Howard a sermon of his own, claiming that there is no order, no spirituality, no binding logic to the world beyond currency, and that he is halting the natural progression of the world. Beale then preaches the gospel of the inevitability of dying democracy and dehumanization. When the ratings start to tank, Diana wants to fire Beale, but Mr. Jensen won't allow it. Max breaks up with Diana, and pushed to desperation, management conspires to kill Howard Beale. Boom, he's dead. End of movie.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
All right, guys. So let's just start off talking about just what is this movie about?
It's about so many things.
It's about a lot of things.
It's about the, as I said before.
Oh, you know what? Actually, I'm sorry. We wanted to continue talking about context. Sorry. So yeah, I kind of jumped ahead a little bit more. So, Alec, do you want to get started? So Alec and I were both reading this Nieman report called The Transformation of Network News by Mark Gunter. And this kind of gives us a little bit of context as to what happened with news that this movie is commenting on.
Yeah, it was what we were talking about before, but I can just loosely quote it. This was written in the 90s, but it says 20 years ago, there was no network news business. The big three broadcast television networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC all covered news, but none generally made money doing so, nor did they expect to turn a profit from news programming. They presented news programming for the prestige it would bring to their network to satisfy the public service requirements of Congress and the FCC, and more broadly, so that they would be seen as good corporate citizens. So that's I think for anyone living in today, that's sort of a long memory that seems so distant now.
Right. Now news is very obviously and overtly entertainment.
Which is what this movie's about.
Is largely what this movie is about, yeah.
And it's horrible, the news.
Yeah.
The news sucks.
Sage, right. are you aware, I was telling Jared about this earlier, I had come across a fact on IMDb that George Clooney wanted to remake this for television.
Really?
Yeah, this was like 2005, and he screened it for a bunch of like teenagers and young adults. And he's like, yeah. None of them understood what was going on and did not understand that it was satire. And then George Clooney realized that's because like none of this was surprising to them.
Yeah, it had happened. It'd be like a documentary now.
Right? Yeah.
All the more elements of how prophetic this movie is. So interestingly, that same article that Alec was talking about goes on to talk about why this happened. And at least according to this article, they say that it wasn't necessarily just that they were greedy, but that the TV entertainment business has deteriorated because programming costs were on a rise due to more competition, ratings are falling, and hit shows are harder to find. So we actually find ourselves in a place now where the news actually subsidizes entertainment because it's a lot easier to make the news a hit because you can sensationalize whatever horrible thing is happening in the world. It's a lot easier to do that than it is to find like a hit narrative show.
You mean because, and you're talking about like the hit cable news stuff, right? Like, because I don't feel like the network news is still, I think they still have these same problems, don't they? I don't know much about this.
So wait, what problems?
I mean, are you saying that now news is subsidizing, like which programs are you talking about that are you saying all news programs are really profitable now that are subsidizing entertainment?
Well, yeah. Certainly with like, I'm not sure about like ABC, CBS, and NBC, but certainly, you know, CNN, Fox News.
Right. Yeah. Those are the biggest shows on TV like Hannity and Rachel Maddow, basically.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm just saying that, like, those are what are making the conglomerations the big
Right.
The big
okay.
Money,
yeah.
More
exactly.
So than like,
and it's way more like the network kind of news where it's just one guy's raging opinion, you know, than right. It is, you know, researched reporting, you know.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to add that, like, basically, like Neil Postman's argument in the book I was mentioning earlier, "Amusing Ourselves to Death," is that this is basically the inevitable outcome of the medium of television.
Right.
That TV is built to entertain. It's not built to inform. So anything that attempts to do that is eventually just going to be corrupted and corroded by TV into something that's more entertaining. And that's what network is all about.
And I think that's what's really interesting about like Max Schumacher's relationship with Diana is that it's sort of like he is the old school news anchor with integrity, but is constantly, like he says that Diana is TV incarnate, but it's essentially like he's being seduced by the sort of like fun, ephemeral, like entertainment that is slowly like removing his humanity.
Yeah, it's an allegory. Like, right. He represents the old news, she represents the new news, and they're like, him falling in love with her is about that corruption.
Right.
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 Yeah. She really represents just like a person that has grown up with TV, like all absorbed, encompassing, you know, like what is he, the quote is something about like her Looney Tunes.
Bugs Bunny mindset. Generation.
Bugs Bunny generation. Yeah. Like that's what she is just someone who has eaten, slept, and breathed television since the day she was born. And then William Holden's kind of like, you know, the guy who.
God, it's just
that
later
just, on. When and you that's kind of like us with the internet.
That,
you know?
That you just made me think, like, what would the YouTube generation version of network be?
Exactly.
It just kind of made my spine tingle.
Yeah. I had that same thought watching. I rewatched the movie today when I had that same thought watching that scene where there's such a generational conflict in this movie that is exactly like between the baby boomers and millennials today, where, you know, the knock on millennials is that we're so caught up in the internet, right? Mm-hmm. And we don't pay attention to anything. And he's saying that to her about her generation, you know, 40 years ago. It's kind of like a constant, right?
Well, yeah. I honestly would go a step further and say that, you know, here we are, we're kind of the older millennials. I mean, I don't know about you, but I'm 32, and like us, like the gap between us who got the internet around 14, 13 or whatever, or a little younger, and then the people who have literally grown up with the internet encompassed in all the social media, that's to me a gap too. I talk to, you know, 8-year-olds at family reunions, and it's crazy, you know, just yeah. The kind of gap just between on how we live our lives and see the world. And I guess that's been the truth since the dawn of time, but especially pertinent now, I think.
Yeah, I don't necessarily want to be like the, oh, this younger generation, blah, blah, blah. Like, but I don't even think that's what the movie about. Like, I don't think, I mean,
and that's not what I'm saying either.
Yeah, yeah, no.
Yeah, but it's more just like the technology is like TV for Faye Dunaway, you know, is social media for the kids today, you know, growing up in it. It just changes your brain.
So I would disagree that, I mean, there is an element of that. As much as I don't want to be the angry guy on the porch saying these damn kids today, there is an element of nostalgia in this movie. And there's a kind of like a skepticism toward the new generation and like the utter nihilism of the Bugs Bunny generation. So Beale and Max are always talking about the heroic days of their past with Murrow, when the integrity of their work was protected. And Diana is kind of the nihilism of the new generation. And something that this reminded me of The Godfather. The Godfather is a film that's actually kind of similar to this one, in that The Godfather, we see Don Corleone is basically like Max Schumacher, because Don Corleone is the old school. He's like, he's the criminal with values. He says that we're never going to touch drugs because drugs will ruin our communities. But then there's somebody like Sollozzo who's going to inevitably come up, and he is going to start selling drugs. And unless Don Corleone loses or just casts aside his moral scruples, he will be cast out and he will become antiquated, just like what happens to Max Schumacher. And then there's that beautiful shot, that famous shot in The Godfather, where after Don Corleone dies, his grandson crosses the frame as if to say, you know, like the old guard has died and has gave birth to the new generation. There's that line where he says, "I feel lousy about the pain that I've caused my wife and kids. I feel guilty and conscience stricken. And all of these things you think sentimental, but to my generation is called simple human decency." So there is this kind of talking shit about the kids, you know?
Right.
Yeah, it's definitely there.
All right, so I want to go listing through just some of the ways that this movie is prophetic. So the first one we've already talked about, and that is news as entertainment. So Alec and I are actually working on a script right now about largely about the news, but we stumbled upon this thing that in the New York Times profile of CNN President Jeff Zucker, it says, as Zucker sees it, his pro-Trump panelists are not just spokespeople for a worldview. They are characters in a drama, members of CNN's extended ensemble cast. And we can all shit on CNN, and they're not the only ones that this becomes a problem to, but that's one of the things that's prophetic. We've already talked about that. We already talked about mega corporations buying out news. I mean, even as recently as 2009, General Electric bought NBC.
I mean, right now, like the Fox-Disney deal is
crazy. Exactly, right. Oh, yeah. And then the other one...
I never thought of, I always thought about Disney owning X-Men and not Disney owning Fox News. Is that going to happen?
No, that's no. The one department they're not buying.
Gotcha.
For real.
Okay.
Because it costs too much money.
No, it's because they're too controversial.
They can get a cultural monopoly without Fox News. So.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
And I think another thing is that this movie prophesized anger and outrage as a profit engine for media.
Yeah.
That hadn't really happened yet. But even Diana's character says that American people want somebody to articulate their rage for them.
Manufactured dissent.
Yeah, and these days in the internet, I think that's been put on mega steroids, because even these days you find like internet people who like literally just target markets of people that need their rage articulated independent of truth, and they will fill that market.
Absolutely.
So don't get me wrong. The internet is certainly utilizing outrage, but I think like the kind of outrage that they're talking about, like, I don't even know if it's prophetic, because there's certainly lots of examples in history of like tapping into like a cultural anger, usually for bad reasons. Like, you know, you could say that Goebbels and Hitler did this with the German people and did all sorts of terrible things with that, you know, any sort of populist. So I think what he's like, that part's not prophetic, but it's like, you know,
right, but Goebbels and Hitler weren't doing it in search of profit. Either like just like pure anger for profiteering is what I'm talking about.
Yeah, in context of the news, I think like in that cycle there were businesses that like took advantage of the situation. But yeah, on the news, on television, to my knowledge, and you also have to remember, like, TV news is what, 20 years old in 1976, 25 years old, maybe 30. It's like very, very young.
Like Hot Topic, you know, or like the commodification of just like punk rock.
Yeah.
You know, yeah, this $40 t-shirt is going to stick it to the man.
And they don't care about the message at all in network. And the other like thing that they predict is that they co-opt any other message that's out there, right? Like there's this whole plot line with the communists in network that are having all of these insurrections around the country. Well, not insurrections, but like they're, you know, all these they're all over the place spreading their message, and then the network brings them in to like have their own TV show about their rebellion, and then all of a sudden you have this amazing scene where a communist is arguing about her contract, where
it's like, one of my favorite scenes of the movie.
And I'll, don't fuck with my distribution costs.
It's even to me, as someone who follows communist stuff, it's what's even more amazing. So like for Lorraine Hobbs is like very loosely based off of Angela Davis, who's like a very prominent like communist activist. So then there's Ahmed Khan, who isn't part of the Communist Party, but is part of the Ecumenical Liberation Front. And she's got this speech about like how they're like this armed vanguard movement that the Communist Party doesn't support because it's not time yet, which like this was happening like in the 60s with the Communist Party in France yelling at student protesters. So I thought that was like a nice like sort of historically accurate thing to bring up. But then like during that conversation, she's like insulting, like it's funny because like she, the Communist Party, who hates Ahmed Khan and his like vanguard, violent, whatever, is forced to deal with him because of making money. And she's also saying things like, you know, the Communist Party isn't going to see a goddamn dime from this until syndication happens.
Right. It's so good. It's so good.
Yeah.
So the last prophetic thing that before we start breaking these down is that at the end, there's kind of this prophetic thing of capitalism not needing democracy, which I think is super interesting. But let's focus on what Ryan is talking about, because when I say what is this movie about, I think that this is kind of the big message, is the way that the system, whether it's specifically capitalism, I think that like the way that this movie is an awesome display of the power of capitalism to protect itself. It's amazing. So it kind of commodifies rebellion in three ways. One, rebelling against the establishment. So the establishment tries to sell you an anti-establishment message. Basically, a show about railing against the system is the system's number one hit show that causes the system to thrive. And I love this, the scenes where Diana's like, I don't want conventional programming on this network. I want counterculture. I want anti-establishment. And I love the part where they're telling Peter Finch's character that he's going to be on TV again. And he says, what's wrong with being an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our time? What do you think, Max? Do you want to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our time? Yeah, I think I'd like to be an angry prophet denouncing the hypocrisies of our time. The nonchalance and the triviality of how they use that word, which is, or that term that should seemingly be weighted with seriousness, right, just is
right,
proof. And
because he's basically just saying, like, yeah, I'd like a job.
Exactly. He's like, yeah, I'll have a job. And it's as if the actual content of the title that he's giving himself is just taken, all meaning is taken away. And it's exactly what capitalism does in this situation, is anything that threatens it, it will co-opt and basically just neuter it of any effectiveness. It's amazing.
It's a well-run machine.
So another thing that, and this one is less focused on, but religion. So they commodify the term prophet. There's that stained glass window behind Howard, just to sell something that is overtly without moral scruples, which I think is pretty hilarious. But this is basically what Sage said earlier, is that the last thing that's commodified is revolutionary unrest. Because even communist revolutionaries will sell out their anti-capitalist message to capitalism because they don't want people fucking with their distribution costs. It's so good.
Yeah. Do you want me to talk about DeBoard or later?
Real quick, we were talking about cool examples of kind of the, I don't know what you call this, the network subgenre of media.
Oh, there's so many.
And Nelson Smith in our live comments said, a face in the crowd is another great example of this, starring Andy Griffith.
Andy Griffith, that's a great movie.
He says it's another movie that predicted media personalities that manipulated the populace. And yeah, he's totally right. That movie does that.
That movie's awesome.
And that movie's fucking awesome. And that
Lonesome
was 20
Roads,
years
right?
before, 30 years before
Network,
which, you know, so this is, I feel like really, even though this movie is about what media and giant corporations and stuff, this really at the core of it is a human psychology thing. You know, like the whole just the populist angry prophet is kind of, you know, has been around for a long time, is kind of all I'm saying. And has been in media, obviously, for a long time, too. Right. Like someone that can manipulate the populace and doesn't really believe in their message necessarily.
But he's not really like Peter Finch's character.
Andy Griffith?
Well, no, not. I'm talking back about Network. I don't think he really does successfully do anything because, once again,
but he's being used, and he knows he's being used for this profit machine.
I can never really tell how much he knows he's being used or not. I mean,
he's crazy,
but he also thinks that he's always telling the truth, right? Like he doesn't think he's lying about anything at any point, and he's kind of looking for a worldview, I think. So at the beginning of the movie, when he says, you know, God is bullshit, and it's because, you know, nobody knows anything. We're all looking for someone to tell us how things are. And then at the end of the movie, he has that confrontation with the guy who owns the company, Jensen, who gives him a worldview. Basically, he breaks down how things should operate, and then his mind is completely changed, and that's what he believes then. But he's always thinking that he's telling the truth.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And even on the show, he's even saying on the show, like, look at these people. They only care about me, you know, because of the ratings. Like, he's saying that on the show and stuff. So he's being transparent, but that's also, in a way, it becomes his brand, which gets commodified.
Yeah. Right. There's no escape.
It's a vicious cycle, baby.
I was confused about why he so, like, readily accepts Jensen's view of the world.
Oh, this is great. This is actually one of the things I wanted to talk about with you guys.
Yeah, go for it.
Well, because there's such a... this is like a good way to like look at the different ways that we look at stuff. Because your channel is all about philosophy and decoding the meanings of things. And I'm looking more at like narrative theory, I guess.
Yeah.
So I kind of break down like, you know, why things work as a story. And as much as I like love this movie, I think it kind of falls apart in a few ways at the end. Mm-hmm. And like one of those things is that, like, yeah, it kind of feels really sudden that Howard Beale just starts believing Jensen, even though like I think, like, if we can talk about the meaning of what the movie means at the end, I think it all adds up. But it does like start moving like real quickly, and there's like a lot of voiceover that's necessary to like get you through to the next plot point.
Right.
So
it actually reminded me of where currently producing a script on why The Phantom Menace is a terrible movie. And one of the things we talk about is like Queen Amidala is a bad character because she has no agency. Like she's manipulated, and sure, that's part of the plot, but she like doesn't really struggle with it. She is just sort of like a paper boat, like, you know, sailing down some stream. And weirdly, I fucking love this movie, and I think like it ends up working and it's fine. But like Howard Beale, I think, has like some of those problems. And I think like that moment is indicative of that. What do you guys think?
I actually asked Alec this morning, like, why does Mr. Jensen want him to preach this on the air and lose money for the company?
Oh, so that makes sense to me.
Is that not the question Sage was asking?
No, he's asking why Howard Beale gets told by Jensen, like, you.
Oh, why does Howard Beale believe him?
Yeah.
Like, I think we can put together an answer from the movie.
So, I mean, I get, yeah, this, the reason why it works for me is largely the reason why, what's the actor's name who played Mr. Jensen?
Ned Beatty.
Ned Beatty won an Oscar. Nominated. And I don't, you know, sometimes there's just a scene in which the actor has such an awesome performance that I just buy it. And the performative nature of his performance and the way that the thing is shot and lit, and it looks like he's basically trying to emulate the religious revelation of the voice that came to Howard Beale in his bed when he was sleeping in the middle of the night. It just makes sense to me that like through his performance, he was able to literally just like preach to him and yeah. just instill the message in an almost religious manner.
Yeah, no, that scene is fantastic. And
am I getting through to you, Mr. Beale?
That's right. Yeah, he totally drops the persona for a second.
What was that Oscar quote? By Ned Beatty? Ryan, were you talking about it?
Squeal like a piggy.
That's him?
Yeah.
Ned Beatty plays... Wait, you're talking about in Deliverance.
Yeah.
Ned Beatty plays the redneck?
He's the one tied to the tree.
Oh, yes. So he's the one who squeals like a pig.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Okay.
That's his quote. No. Is that what you're talking about, Alan?
No, Ned Beatty's advice about never turning down work.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he said after this movie, he goes, never turn down work, actors, because I worked on Network for a day and got an Oscar nomination for it. So.
Oh, he didn't win.
I don't think he won.
Oh, okay, never mind.
No, he did. Nope, wait.
Oh, he did. All right, good job. Yeah.
No, I could be wrong. I think I am wrong. He didn't. Oh, okay. He also played the pink bear in Toy Story 3, I'm pretty sure, though.
I think you're right.
We've all seen the headlines in the news of how someone lost their life in an act of cold-blooded murder. And while it's sad and grabs your attention, most people go on with their day without giving it another thought. But have you ever stopped to think about the life of the person at the center of the news story? They were more than just a headline or a statistic. They were someone's loved one or friend. I'm Mike Morford, and my podcast, The Murder of My Family, dives into some of those stories to help listeners get to know the person who was lost and how their death affected those closest to them. Listen to The Murder of My Family everywhere you listen to podcasts. There are well over 100 episodes to binge on now.
Okay, so all right, back to Sage's question.
Yeah, so it does make like it makes sense what happens. I guess I'm just saying, like, when you're watching the movie, it sort of gets hard to keep up with it, just mm-hmm. from like how the scenes are put together at the end. And again, like, just when I rewatched it, I had this intuition that the voiceover would only come in at the act breaks of the movie. And it looks like it's doing that for like 75% of the movie. But then like right at the end, there's like three or four voiceovers that are necessary to get right to the next plot point. Right. So it just starts getting like you start seeing the gears turning is all I'm saying. But like the overall effect of what happens makes sense thematically.
So I think I have an answer, but it's super wanky. So because right, Austin is not with us today, I'm doing it for you, brother.
You gotta up the wank.
I gotta up the wank. Okay, so one of the things that Alec and I are also working on a video about these kind of stories, about the kind of resistance is futile, commodifying rebellion stories. Like, remember Simple Rick's Wafers Select? You know, that's the same thing. We talked about this in The Matrix Reloaded. We talked, and if you saw Sorry to Bother You, there's a lot of that in there. And one of the things that led us to is this idea of acceleration. And we're actually also, this enabled us to go take a next step into another video that we're working on, which is about why satire and parody has becoming reality lately. Like, so a great example is Chappelle's show. Trading Spouses was a joke. Less than 5 years later, it was a real show. And, you know, so in our Bo Burnham episode, we talked about this famous Marx quote about first as a farce, then as a tragedy.
First as tragedy, then as farce.
Oh, excuse me. First as a tragedy, then as a farce. But I think that something different is going on these days. And I think it's first as satire, then as either reality or cynical reality. And we see this a couple times in Network. So the first one is at the beginning when Diana is pitching the idea of the anti-establishment revolutionary show, the people say, what are we going to call it? The Mao Zedong Hour? And then it turns out that by the end of the movie, it's called the Mao Zedong Hour. First, as literally they say that as a satirical point, a joke, and then it becomes real. Robert Duvall says, Jesus, Diane, we're talking about putting a manifestly irresponsible man on public television. And then she just nods and smirks. And this is kind of the point where the absurdity becomes real. And then I think that the culmination of this is the end of the movie when they say, well, I suppose we have to kill him. Because at the beginning, I think, I don't know, I'm curious how you guys read it. When they first bring this up, the idea of killing Howard Beale because his ratings are too low, someone, the first person who mentions it is probably at least 60% joking. But as they continue to say it, it just becomes real. And I think the most beautiful part about this is that on a meta level, the satire of the movie becomes reality. At first, Network was a satire, and like what Alec was saying earlier about the whole George Clooney thing, it's now just reality to the point where contemporary audiences look at it and they can't even tell that it's a satire.
I would say something about that point. If IMDb trivia is any, if you take that as any real source, it says that Sidney Lumet and Patty Chesky didn't see it as a satire when they were making it. They thought they were commenting on what was going on at the time. That's what IMDb trivia says.
Yeah. So this goes to like they were describing the times rather than, yeah, I don't know. But
so anyway, to answer Sage's question, this is going to, and when I talk about acceleration, what are we accelerating to? Why is it that what is once a satire or a joke in our culture moves so fast these days that it eventually just becomes the status quo? So this is where I think the Mr. Jensen thing comes up, and it becomes that capitalism basically no longer, or is getting clearer and clearer that it no longer needs democracy. And that's essentially what Mr. Jensen is telling Howard Beale to preach at the end of the movie, is that democracy is dead and that we are going to continue to be dehumanized. And so one of the philosophers that Alec and I follow, Slavoj Žižek,
so, and this is like you're sort of talking about why it makes sense that the end of the movie is a little sloppier.
Yeah, I guess I'm saying, like, what if I'm going to apologize for the movie for ending abruptly, I guess I'm saying that this is the point that it's at least trying to come across, and that is that the inevitability of capitalism not needing democracy, and that that Howard Beale just accepts the inevitability of a corporate autocracy.
And describe what you mean by, or what you think the movie means by, capitalism doesn't need democracy.
So if we look at Mr. Jensen's speech, he says that at the end of his speech, he says, "In all of our children, Mr. Beale, will see a perfect world in which there's no war or famine, oppression or brutality. One vast and ecumenical holding company for whom all men will work and serve a common profit, in which all men will hold a share of stock, all necessities provided, all anxieties tranquilized, all boredom amused. And I've chosen you, Mr. Beale, to preach this evangel." So
there's also, he says a little bit earlier in that same thing, he says, "You are an old man who thinks in terms of nations and peoples. There are no nations. There are no peoples. There are no Russians. There are no Arabs. There is no West. There is only one holistic system of systems, multinational dominion of dollars."
Right. So what I'm saying is that capitalism, so we can look at China today, and a lot of philosophers are looking at China and seeing that capitalism can be more dynamic and efficient when it functions perfectly within an authoritarian state. So that, I think, is basically what Mr. Jensen is describing with a, instead of it being like a strong man or like a politician, is literally a corporation that has a centralized power that basically needs it so that, well, we don't even need democracy if, you know, like all of our interests are funneled up to a single leading corporation.
That's kind of paralleled nicely earlier in the film when like Howard Beale gets people to write in to the White House to tell them to stop the merger between the, to stop the one company from buying the other company. So that's like an uprising of democracy trying to curtail the will of capitalism that is completely reverted by Jensen's speech. Right?
And it's the one it's the one thing that gets him in trouble. Like, he can say everything's crooked and life is bullshit and even like the network is bullshit, but as soon as he interferes with a merger, which is like hurting their bottom line, that's when Arthur says, "You have meddled with the primal forces of nature, Mr. Beale, and I will not have it."
Right.
Right. And the consolidation of these giant conglomerations is like the penultimate late capitalism thing.
Right. Okay. I see what you're saying.
So the other sort of line in this is just that Arthur Jensen says, it is the international system of our currency which determines the totality of life on this planet. In other words, like if money is determining things, there's not really a lot of room for like people to determine things.
But yeah. but people are the ones that own the money.
Well, I think in this context,
he's
saying
on how to use it.
He's talking in the context of like international conglomerates. Like it is their. They're the ones who are deciding where the money flows, if that makes sense.
Okay. I guess this kind of predicts corporations as people as well.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah. All right, so we didn't get to talk about DeBoer. Did you want to say something about that, Alec?
Yeah, I actually think, I mean, it's a good, this is kind of relevant. Real quick before I get into DeBoer, you were talking about how things are first as farce and then, I guess, as tragedy. And actually, like, the first and last scenes, if you think about it, first of all, the movie's a story kind of about Howard Beale kills himself. Like, he wants to kill himself on air, and then he ends up getting himself killed on air. But it starts off as a joke, and Max is saying, like, oh, you'll probably get 50 share, ha, ha, ha.
Exactly.
And so that is the farce that's happening in the bar, and then it happens as a tragedy as they exploit this, you know, man with mental health issues. But
it also works the other way, where it's a tragedy when he's saying he's going to kill himself on the air, right? Because then it's, you're seeing his depression. But then, yeah, at the end of the movie, it's just like the whole end of the movie is just a pun on the phrase "a network would kill for ratings," right?
Yeah, yeah. So it's both a farce and then tragedy, and tragedy then farce.
Yeah,
it goes both ways.
It's a good movie. It's multi-layered.
Yeah, it's multi-layered.
It's so good.
So I think. I mean, I think Guy Debord speaks a lot to this. Guy Debord was a French philosopher who invented is responsible for a school of thought called like situationism. But he wrote a really good book that's just a series of theses called The Society of the Spectacle. And one, it's very short. It's like half a page or a page where he talks about like how rebellion gets commodified. And the exact line that I've underlined is the smug acceptance of what exists can also merge with purely spectacular rebellion. This reflects the simple fact that dissatisfaction itself became a commodity as soon as economic abundance could extend the production to the processing of such raw materials. But anyway, his whole thing is that like we might see discord or disagreement in society, let's say between Republicans and Democrats, or between, well, I was gonna say the left and the right, but that's the same example, but like companies versus other companies. And we could think of these, what he's saying incorrectly, as like different sort of sectors that represent very different things. And while that's kind of true, what he says is they are all sort of produced by the system itself and represent the system of capitalism. So he says, like, the system often posits gives us false choices. I like to use the example of, like, it says, oh, you have freedom to choose Pepsi and Coke. And you might even say, like, oh, I'm a Coke fan, fuck Pepsi. He says that the system always sort of stokes those flames to create sort of this spectacular and very tribalistic like infighting, but it's all to distract from the overarching system, which is, you know, that like money dictates things.
Yeah, fuck Pepsi.
Yeah, fuck
Sorry,
Pepsi.
I just needed to throw that in there.
So like it's easy to look at Howard Beale and say like, oh, he's railing against the system, he's not part of the system. But what DeBoard would say is that the system is already sort of promoting these sorts of things because it's learned to, as the movie shows, commodify them, and it's not actually threatening them. And what I think is, and DeBoard doesn't say this necessarily, but the best part of this is that, again, when he actually gets in trouble is when he threatens a merger, which would mean a loss of, I assume, millions of dollars or maybe even billions of dollars. And that is the one thing the system sort of cannot accept. Yeah, so I think it's like he's a really interesting thinker to think about in context of this movie.
Totally.
I wonder how that jives with, at the end of Jensen's speech, he starts listing all the things that capitalism does. And I think one of them is he says that all anxieties will be tranquilized. which, you know, it kind of, I read also like recently, I don't know where I read this, but that the primary product of capitalism is anxiety. that it's really, yeah. You know, advertising is really good at making us anxious and wanting things. I wonder, does that line fit with that view of how capitalism is also going to incorporate dissatisfaction? And
I kind of think that line is, like, to your point, like, it's kind of wrong, or maybe, like, it's not wrong. It's like, I think this is like the very utopian vision of capitalism that as being written here is like, yeah, it'll account for all of your needs. You'll be well fed. You'll be housed. You know, you'll never be bored. And that is sort of like the utopian vision of capitalism. But like to your point, what was it? I saw books about anxiety are up in sales by like 25%.
Right. Yeah, Alex said that today.
Yeah.
25% year over year.
But you can also
is
think
that
about
just
like,
since Trump was elected or
I don't know how many years it's been, but it's been at least 2 years.
But it also speaks to like early advertising. For instance, like halitosis was sort of I don't know if the term was invented, but certainly popularized by Listerine, where they're like, oh, did you know you secretly had this medical problem that like people judge you for called bad breath? We're going to call it halitosis to make it seem more legit. Or I don't remember if it was Gillette or Schick, but, you know, women weren't buying razors because men used razors to shave their beards. And they're like, oh, do you have unsightly, you know, underarm hair? So they will invent anxieties to sell them people. And, you know, today we see dick pills everywhere and, you know, God knows what. So I think, yeah, to your point, Sage, like, I think you're right. And I think it doesn't necessarily hold true what Jensen's saying or hopes to be true.
Or maybe it's like, your anxiety is being tranquilized momentarily by mm-hmm. these things that are incorporated into capitalism, like the, you know, Howard Beale raging against the machine for 5 minutes. That tranquilizes your anxiety for a bit. You have the catharsis of someone doing that without it actually being real, right?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool, guys. Well, we're going to quickly go into the mailbag. I got a couple questions. So this one is about, we did an episode on the Star Wars backlash, and I know that Sage has done 2 videos on The Last Jedi, so I want to get his thoughts on this as well. So Uh-oh. He said, it's nothing too crazy. I was thinking about
stuff. You just doubled the number of comments on this video.
Oh, yeah. I mean, dude, let me tell you something. I saw your thumbnail where it said good writing with The Last Jedi, and I was like, dude, that dude is in for a world of pain.
Smoky.
I know. It's crazy.
Oh, I know. Yeah. People are mad. Anyway, so this is from Rachel. Rachel says, I was thinking about Star Wars, and perhaps the real issue is that as an intellectual property, Star Wars is losing relevance. Just as very few people like Flash Gordon, Tarzan, or John Carter of Mars anymore, perhaps this is the trajectory of that Star Wars is on. A legacy IP that is gradually on the way out. People might hate the new films, but does it really matter if the IP is becoming culturally irrelevant? Anyway, we'll always have the original trilogy. Best wishes, Rachel. What do you guys think?
I mean, didn't Last Jedi still make a ton of money?
Yes, but Solo didn't.
Okay, right. So if we're talking about Solo and stuff, then
Solo not so much, but I'd say that the new trilogy is probably more relevant than Star Wars has ever been. Considering that it's basically about, you know, the rise of alt-right movements, and, you know, I think Kylo Ren is a pretty modern take on a villain. So
I just think in general, every single piece of IP has been revamped, rebooted, brought up to new cultural standards. So I don't really even know if I believe that a piece of IP can just die out.
Yeah, well, take Mission Impossible, for instance. It's so far removed, the one that just came out from, like, the one that came out, the first one. It's, like, right. A completely different genre, pretty much.
And or even how is Power Rangers still kicking? It's doing great. You know, it's continuing to revolutionize its relevance. Now they have, like, a mobile game in which you can do, like, Street Fighter versus Power Rangers. Like, what the... Like, they're just still continuing to make it relevant.
Certain IPs can do it, I guess. Certain IPs are not.
I was just going to say, the media landscape is constantly expanding as well, and it's getting more niche. So there's just always more space for these IPs to breathe.
Yeah. All right, so one more question. This is about the 40-year-old virgin. So he says, hey, I stumbled across your guys' reviews, and I listened to your review on the 40-year-old virgin. I wanted to say I'm a 20-year-old virgin male. I think you guys made great points on the peer pressure of being a virgin at this age. Watching the movie, I felt anxiety, like I got to lose my virginity. So many great points you guys made. Enjoy. Thanks. From Anonymous.
Good luck.
Yeah, man.
Well, I mean, so we talked. So Ryan is the only one that was on this podcast with me. We talked about how the 40-year-old virgin, you know, if you watch it today, you're just like, shit, man. Now I understand why people could be so frustrated if they haven't lost their virginity, because, you know, you watch this movie and you're like, wow, if I haven't lost my virginity by 40, I'm going to be literally the butt of a cultural joke.
Right. Yeah, I know. That's you articulated it really well in that podcast.
I will say in my teens, as maybe a late bloomer is the word that I will use, my friends were always giving me shit. But now they have like really shitty relationships and I feel like I have good ones. So like, fuck them.
You won.
You won in the
game. Yeah. They're just like always like getting in screaming matches with their girlfriend, and their girlfriend's always screaming at them, and it's just fuck them.
And it's all because they had sex in high school.
Yeah, well, I'm not gonna say that, but you know, like I in retrospect, like I don't really. It doesn't matter. Like nobody gives a shit.
If you're listening to this, you're young and you haven't had sex yet. It really doesn't matter.
Yeah, nobody cares. Nobody.
Yeah,
cares.
No one gives a shit later. It's like it doesn't make. Yeah, it doesn't mean anything. Yeah. Try to do it before you're 30, though, I'd say.
Yeah, I would.
Aspiration.
The whole message. I would just say the big piece of wisdom from the movie is don't put the pussy on a pedestal.
Right. Oh, that's what they say in the movie.
Yeah, right. The, wise words of wisdom from the 40-year-old virgin. All right, we're going to wrap it up. So first of all, I want to thank Sage for joining us. Thank you, Sage. It was great having you.
Thank you so much. This was wonderful.
So you guys got to, if you haven't already heard about it, you got to check out Sage's YouTube channel. It's called Just Right. That's W-R-I-T-E. He's all about breaking down narrative theory, and he'll get you off your ass in writing if you are a writer.
He also has a great network video.
He's got a great network video, yes, which is why we decided to do this collaboration, because it's a movie he loves, it's a movie we love, and his video on it is great. So if you want some more insights on network, definitely check out his video.
Thank you.
So, before we leave, where can we find you on the internet, Ryan?
You can find me at Ryan Shorts and Ryan's Game Show on YouTube and Facebook. I'm releasing a video about how I'm the first human being that has learned how to fly. You know, you can you know how we only use 10% of our brains?
Yeah.
I figured out how to use the others to make myself fly.
I was wondering where your car was.
Exactly. Yeah. Dude, I can't wait to show you after this podcast.
Okay.
Anyway, go over, and that's coming out probably this week. So, definitely this week.
And Alec.
You can find me on Twitter at WisecrackAlec.
And Sage.
I'm on Twitter at Sage Hyden.
Cool. All right, guys. Thank you so much for joining us. A reminder, next week we're doing Akira. And if you have time, please leave us a review on iTunes. It's much appreciated. But that's all from us today. So thanks a lot, guys. Peace.
Goodbye from Hollywood, California. We're mad as hell. We're not going to take it anymore. You're a human being, goddammit. Your life has value.
Peace.
Yeah.